Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Tonight, I'm very excited to introduce Josh Chetwynd and his book, The Secret History of Balls. Josh is a journalist for USA Today and US News and World Report, and he's a former professional baseball player and the author of two other books with far more serious titles about the history of baseball in Europe. But we're here to talk about balls. Josh's new book is a fun look into the history and evolution of balls that we use in sports, from single incidences that change tradition to marks of social evolution that influence them. So let's talk about some balls. Ladies and gentlemen, Josh Chetwynd.
Oh my. Thank you very much. I appreciate the introduction. I must say, I'm not a urologist, so this is nothing to do with that. And for anyone who thought that I was going to be an intro act for Larry Flint, the famed Hustler publisher, who will be here on Thursday, I'm afraid that's not the case. This book is about the history of sports and recreation balls, but it's not a dry book. It's not the type of book where it's textbook, where you're learning about, you know, how the balls were necessarily made. I think it's more of a sort of a cultural look, using balls as almost a cipher. What I'd love to do is just read the introduction to the book, because it'll give you a really good sense of what the book is about, and then talk a little bit about some of the more enjoyable anecdotes that come to mind, and then answer any questions. So I'm going to start off with a little introduction. It's relatively short, so I won't try to bore you for too long with it. First things first, before embarking on a history of balls, we need to know what we're talking about. Depending on the conversation, the word can mean courage, a part of the male anatomy, a place where Cinderella longs to go, or a thing pretty much every human has played with at one time or another. For the purpose of this book, we're looking at the latter. Apologies for those who expected something a little saucier. Even when we get that far, there's still questions. What exactly constitutes a ball? Does it have to be round? Does it have to bounce? Is a sphere the same as a prolate spheroid, which is the technical term for the shape of a football or a rugby ball? These are the questions that have vexed even the greatest athletes. Once, after an Irish rugby star finished a big match, he ran into the writer James Joyce at the local bar. The erudite author told the player, "You didn't play with a ball today. By definition, balls are round, nor even an oval, which demands a plane configuration. You played with a prolate spheroid." Without skipping a beat, the player reportedly responded, "Jesus, Jim, so that's what I bloody scored with." With all due respect to Joyce, nowadays a ball means so much more than just a sphere. I've opted to cover just about every quote-unquote rounded body, definition courtesy of Encyclopedia Britannica from 1911, that gives us joy on the field, at stadiums and arenas, or in backyards and living rooms around the globe. It didn't matter whether it was a sphere, oval, or prolate spheroid, hollow, solid, full of air or liquid, or stuffed with twine, made of leather, metal, rubber, plastic, or polyurethane. I even included the magic eight ball because, quite honestly, it was too much fun to pass up. One final caveat, focus remained on balls still in play today and their direct ancestors. So the long-gone sphere that was used in the ancient Greek sport episkyros, an old school kicking and throwing game, didn't make the cut. With the ground rules out of the way, I should explain why I wanted to do a book on this topic, besides the fun jokes the friends brought up while I was putting it together. Quite simply, balls are the unsung heroes of sports. They're whacked, smacked, splattered, slapped, flicked, flung, dribbled, crushed, thrown, tossed, and kicked. Alas, despite their central role, balls usually only make headlines when something goes wrong. A tear, the application of an illegal foreign substance, or a dent from overuse. This fact seems a bit odd because if you watch nearly any major sporting event, you're likely to follow the ball, wondering where it will go next. In a way, the modern plight of the ball is particularly surprising because it used to sit center stage. It was a religious artifact in many cultures, and in others, it's been a fantastically polarizing element. On the one hand, you've had great leaders who have gravitated to ball games. The roster of ball players is prestigious. Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Augustus Caesar, Mary Queen of Scots, Henry VIII, Sir Francis Drake, and even Abraham Lincoln, to name a few. But for every sphere supporter, there has been a leader who saw balls and their games as something subversive or degrading. Kings, potentates, and officials from Scotland to Spain and New York to New Zealand have shunned various ball games over the centuries. The typical reasons: games encouraged gambling or took away from more important pursuits such as military preparation. Thomas Jefferson was a particular critic. He once wrote a nephew warning that the young man should avoid ball games because, quote, games played with a ball are too violent for the body and stamp no character on the mind. Famed British writer Jerome K. Jerome joked that if celestial beings looked down on the earth and saw humans playing ball, they would be convinced that, quote, the ball must be some malignant creature of fiendish power, the great enemy of the human race. So what has consigned balls to supporting status? Maybe it has something to do with the Industrial Revolution and mechanization. Once balls could be mass-produced, the little idiosyncrasies that made them seem to come to life disappeared. When every ball is meant to play the same, no wonder people only notice when it's acting oddly. That said, this doesn't mean that balls don't have personality. Like people, they're products of generations of evolution. Elements that we take for granted, including dimples on a golf ball, laces on a football, or even tennis balls' fuzzy fur, are often a reflection of forgotten decisions and actions, some long ago and others more recent. These stories have included class warfare, star-crossed lovers, great minds, world-altering inventions, and matters of life and death. This volume mines the history of sports and recreation to offer the tales through the origins and development of 60 balls, plus if you read closely, information on a handful of other orbs. The book aims to be comprehensive but not exhaustive. The reason? Where there are people who want to have some fun, you'll always find some new or obscure ball popping up. My goal is that after taking a read, you'll agree with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Barbara Tuchman, who once wrote, quote, in human activity, the invention of the ball may be said to rank with the invention of the wheel. Even if you don't, hopefully you won't look at a ball, any ball, the same way again. So that was the introduction, and you know, the book to me was a lot about looking at sort of cultural elements, both in America and abroad. Some of the anecdotes that kind of come to mind that represent this fact: the football. You know, everyone thinks of it as just something you throw through the air, the pigskin. You guys go to Broncos games, I'm sure, not give it much thought. But the pigskin, the football, actually saved a lot of lives. And what happened was that at the start of the 20th century, people were playing with basically this huge, they called it almost like a plum-shaped ball. And the sport was really played as a very violent form of rugby. And they were having dozens, scores of people dying playing this game. It was so bad that Teddy Roosevelt actually got involved, and he brought the potentates of football at the time, we're all Ivy Leaguers, to come to the White House to discuss the issue, because Roosevelt had two sons playing football at Harvard. And he said, you've got to change the game. It's too violent. People are dying. So they decided, okay, well, we'll change the game. We'll allow people to throw the ball. But it didn't matter whether you change the rules. You have to change the ball. And what ended up happening were that innovative coaches like Newt Rockne, who's a very famous coach, came up with a more streamlined football. And in effect, it was the change of the ball that changed the culture of football and made it more of a survivable sport. If you go a little bit more farther afield, one story that really always keeps coming to mind that I found really interesting along this cultural lines is Australian rules football, which is an absolutely rough and tumble sport. But when the sport was invented, the ball actually represented what was basically a proxy for class warfare between the rich and the middle class in Australia. Basically, the 1860s, 1870s, there was a huge immigration influx into the Melbourne area. There was a huge gold rush, and people wanted to make their claims. And the rich people had all come from these very fancy private schools like Eton and Harrow, where all the kings had gone to, and they played soccer there, which was a developing sport in England. And when you were looking at the middle class, they'd all played rugby, a little bit more rough and tumble sport, and they had, of course, gone to schools like rugby. So when these two groups came and they decided, okay, we want to play, we want to have some fun, they decided, what ball are we going to use? And the rich people said, well, we should use a round ball. And the middle class people said, well, let's use a rugby ball. And what was interesting is one of these rare occasions where the middle class actually won out. And they ended up going with much more of a rugby-sized ball, but with a few nods and tips of the hat to the wealthy people, and they rounded the ball off a little bit. So the ball actually reflected something more than just the instrument that they played the game with. Obviously, beyond those types of stories, I tried to have a little fun. If anyone has played with the Magic 8 Ball and looked to it for some sort of solace or advice, you have to ask yourself, if you haven't at this point, why is it an 8 Ball? I mean, why do you have an 8 Ball and you're looking for an 8 Ball for device? I mean, shouldn't it be something else? The story's kind of fun in that the gentleman who invented it was sort of this savant who was actually sort of more famous in his time for going to flop houses than he was for inventing things. He actually passed away right around the time he got the patent for it, and he originally came up with basically a long cylinder that you could turn over and get answers to. The people who bought the patent were a little smarter, and they put it in the form of a crystal ball. And the only reason it became an 8 Ball was because basically Brunswick, which was a famous billiard company, used it once as a one-off promotion, didn't think anything of it, and for whatever reason, people just clung to it. My favorite story about the 8 Ball was that right when it first came out, they got the most amount of questions about the veracity of the answers from the 8 Ball from Washington, D.C. There was a big question whether politicians were among those people looking to the 8 Ball for answers. Beyond that, there are a lot of other fun balls in here, whether it's the Koosh Ball or the Red Playground Ball. I don't know how many people. It's maybe a generational thing. But my big question when I was writing this book was, why is the Red Playground Ball red? Anyone who grew up with this ball, this ubiquitous ball on any playground in any elementary school would know it was red. And why? And I seriously spent a lot of time. The answer is not as earth-shattering as I had hoped it to be, because maybe it would have sold more books, but it was still interesting. I had found one of the original makers of the ball, which was basically put into use in the 1940s, and it was mainly because it scuffed better off of blacktops, and bricks, the color of brick, weathered very well in the sun, and so they decided to go with a red ball. So, you know, there are little sort of quirky facts like that that are quite fun, and then there's sort of the more broader implications stories about culture. I tried to really get into language in every single section there of the 60 main balls. I certainly wrote a little bit about the language relating to various balls. A lot of fun stories. Another very good one, of course, is the Nerf ball, which is, again, whether you're a parent or a child, you have been involved with the Nerf ball. And what is amazing about it is that ball was actually created. It was meant to be a faux foam rock that was going to be used in a game in which cavemen, the name of the game was Cavemen, which you would pretend to be a caveman, and you would throw the rock at each other and try and make money off of it. I don't understand why cavemen had money to begin with, but I have to respect the creative mind of the inventor. He was also the person who invented the game of Twister. So I think he got a lot of leeway, because if you're not, Twister's a good game, maybe cavemen throwing rocks will work. But what happened was is that the people who ended up buying it in one of their early meetings, their stuffed shirts, they started chucking around the rock. And they thought, this is not great as a caveman game. This is great as just a projectile that you can throw in the house. And that's how the Nerf ball started, and it became sort of more of an industry-wide item than just even a ball. So those are really, you know, just some sense of some of these balls. I love this one. There's great illustrations in this book. I had a wonderful illustrator, and I don't know if any of you, does anyone remember the hoppity hop, this little ball that you bounced up and down on? This actually started in England, and amazingly, there was a song that went to the top of the charts about the hoppity hop in England. And in America, they tried to get famous people at the time to support it and to back up the ball. And they got this woman here whose name was, what was her name? Laverne Carter. She was a famous bowler in the 50s. And Laverne would go around from town to town with two bowling balls and her little hoppity hop. And she would do interviews sitting on her hoppity hop, literally like this, holding a bowling ball. And I thought, I don't think you'd get famous people to do that today. I think that was definitely a cultural thing. There are also some more obscure balls that I love that most people would know, and I really enjoyed learning about them. It's the Takwa right here, which is a rattan ball that they use in Malaysia. And I think if most people saw this, you would think this came straight from Crate and Barrel, and it would be that type of ball that you would stick, you know, as a centerpiece. But they actually play a kicking game there, and it's a real tension between people from Thailand and Malaysia over this ball, because the people from Thailand believe that they invented it, and the people from Malaysia believe they invented it. And recently, they changed the ball. There was a technological change to the ball, and the Malaysians had gone to Southeast Asian Games, and they saw this technical change, and they hadn't been consulted, or at least they said that, and they walked out. So the ball can be an instrument that actually leads to some political strife, and it can also be an instrument that helps things. Everyone probably remembers ping pong diplomacy, the Russians, when the Russians and the Americans played ping pong. I'll give you one more anecdote, and then if there are any questions, I would love to answer them, which is the tennis ball, which I love, and this is a really good illustration if you could see it. See, in the 1600s, tennis was played by hand. It was a forerunner game called jeu de paume, and a lot of religious figures were very involved with it, and young religious acolytes were actually charged in a certain area of France to make the balls, and they were told that the bigger the ball you make, the more zeal you have for God. So it became this game of one-upmanship, where people were making bigger and bigger and bigger balls, to the point where the diocese had to say, you've got to stop doing this, because we can't play jeu de paume anymore. These balls are too big. We can't hit a backhand anymore. So they ended up doing that. I hope they also did it for reasons that, you know, I don't think a big ball would necessarily please God, or maybe not. Hard to say. But that gives you sort of a taste of the type of stories that are in here. And I like to believe that they tell us a little bit about culture. They'll tell you a little bit about who we are and where we come from, but also fun, and tell you a lot about pop culture. And so if you have any questions, I would love to answer them. If you want me to just keep on rattling on about various anecdotes, I can do that as well. But
come up with a list.
Yeah, it's a great question. I had to work backwards. So I just tried to search out ball sports. And there were a lot of ball sports that just didn't have unique balls. There's a sport in Poland called Palant. They basically use a tennis ball, and they use sort of a tennis ball type ball. So that didn't make the ball list. But that was the way in which I would have to find the type of balls that would be interesting. There are a few balls that I have in the back. There's sort of an extra ball section. There's a sport in Argentina that was invented in the 1970s called Duni, D-O-O-N-E-E. And literally they play with a ball that looks like, you know, those balloon animals that you see, you know, at the mall. It looks like a connection of all these balloon animals, and they throw this over this huge net, and you start to realize that ball games are very unique to different cultures. That might go over very well in Argentina. I'm not sure in America people would get very excited about throwing balloon animals over a net. So that was another example of sort of a very unique one.
Why cricket ball and a baseball? A, why are they different? And it seems to me you could play baseball with a cricket ball. It would probably curve. So how did they come up with that weird, you know,
figure eight construction here?
For a baseball, and why didn't they just use, you know, a ball without a seam?
Yeah,
is that to make it perfect?
No, it's a fascinating question. And I think that one of the issues when it comes to baseball and cricket, and there was a sport that was actually an offshoot of baseball from Finland, it's called pesäpallo, is that I think that when they were deciding on the fathers of the game, fathers and mothers of these various sports, were deciding on their choice of balls, they didn't want to follow the sport before them. And I think that that had a lot to do with it. I think that it was certainly the case with pesäpallo, this Finnish game. There was a Finnish professor who had come to the United States, and they decided that they wanted to have a sport that was slightly different from baseball, and they made a point of not emulating the baseball. And I suspect that even though there was the cricket ball, and there were other forerunners to baseball like rounders, stool ball, that were these indigenous British games, that the people who were making the baseballs thought, we're going to do it our own way. We're American, we have our own ingenuity, and we're going to do it differently. It was interesting because initially that figure eight shape was not the original ball. It actually kind of looked like a lemon peel, and they called it that because it was sort of four parts coming up, and it looked like a you can almost peel the ball. And when they finally came up with that figure eight construction, which was sort of a more elegant way to put together a ball, there were all these different people who were coming out of the woodwork claiming it. It just proves to me that there is no argument too small, because there were these two towns in Massachusetts where to this day they fight over who was the guy who invented the figure eight on a baseball. There's no money to be made from that, so I don't understand. Anything else?
The technology of golf, a golf ball, seems to change, and everybody claims I got a better ball next week than the one before. Is there really any difference? Measurable?
Absolutely. I really do think so. I think, to me, the example that really supports that is Titleist was founded by a group of MIT PhDs. I mean, the people who are successful now at producing golf balls are people who are really technologically savvy. I would say the two most technological balls out there today, and they couldn't be farther from sort of the social demographic, are on the one hand you've got the golf ball, and on the other hand you have the bowling ball. And those two balls really have the tremendous amount in terms of the feel, and it's gotten so much in bowling that they have to change the oil slicks because the balls have become so well created for each player that they have to make new ways to create handicaps for players. But an interesting story about the golf ball, which is one of my favorite, and I didn't mention it, was the golf ball as we know it today was really innovated because of a statue of Vishnu, which seems very odd. But St. Andrews, of course, the university and the location is sort of the cradle of golf. And there was a professor who was at the University of St. Andrews, and for all you people who love the Royals, that's where Kate and Wills went, to the new prince and princess of he was always the prince, but the new princess of Great Britain. This professor got a package with a statue of Vishnu. And inside the package, so they didn't have any sort of soft, little peanuts or styrofoam that they could put in the way they do today. They had a little rubbery substance, because this had come from Malaysia, called gutta percha. And at the time, they'd used a ball called a feathery. And feathery was an unbelievable marvel in construction. They took a top hat full of feathers and they would stuff it into a regulation size ball. There would be a manufacturer who would take a long iron rod, push it against his chest, and push these feathers into this very small ball. And it was so expensive and so painstaking to do that that's the reason why golf was initially a sport really for the rich. But the son of this professor had gotten some of this gutta percha and realized he could melt it down and he could turn it into the shape of a ball. And what he found was that the ball actually bounded much further. And this was really the start of the use of rubber in balls that really led to our modern balls, because the central element of ball up until more and more recently was rubber. So it's sort of interesting how this one little statue could have been the touchstone for golf innovation. Yes, young man? Yes, I could definitely tell a story about Alexander the Great. I mentioned in the introduction, Alexander the Great was a ball aficionado, and he played polo, which was the game of kings. And when he ascended to the throne in 1336 BC, King Darius of Persia sent him a ball and a mallet. And he meant to say, stick to games, kid. You're not going to really be any sort of leader. And what Alexander the Great said to him, he said, I am the stick, and the ball is the world, and I will conquer it. And so that was one of the great examples of Alexander the Great asserting his authority before he even started invading most of the world and taking over. So.
Good. I was reading National Geographic magazine. This could get you into trouble.
I do know that.
In Afghanistan, it was in Mongolia, I guess, they play a game with a goat head.
Yeah, I talk about it in the book. That was actually the predecessor to polo. And that was sort of the original game that polo came from, and they literally used goat's heads. There are some examples of decapitation in the early ball world. There are a lot of legends that in soccer it started with skulls. There's a sport in Argentina, I don't know why, in which they basically took a duck and they put it in a bag, and you had to ride on horses, pick up this bag with a duck, and throw it into what is basically a large butterfly net, which is beyond me. I would encourage National Geographic to go down to Argentina, because there's a lot of good source material there.
Did you have any surprises in your research, something that you thought you knew about, and then once you delved into the research stuff?
I think there was a lot of that. My favorite is, for anyone who plays field hockey, is that the original field hockey ball was a cube, which just seems so shocking to me. This is not a ball. It was a cube. And the reason was because these guys really just wanted to hack each other. They wanted to take sticks, and they wanted to hit each other really hard. They figured, who cares what ball? We'll stick a cube down there. We don't care. So we're really knocking people. So the Duke of Clarence, who was actually a little bit of a off guy. Some people thought he was Jack the Ripper, but he was the son of King Edward, I think, the seventh. He said, well, we need to have a much more civilized game, and he took it from the British people who were just hacking each other and took it to the more wealthy British people and said, we're going to use a ball instead. So I love that story because it just seems so absolutely odd. Of course, my favorite ball for anyone who can get out to New Zealand, and I will show you a picture, an illustration, is the Zorb Globe, which you can actually ride in. Literally, you get inside of this ball and you roll down a hill in it. This is the ultimate ball. It's like, you know, if anyone ever saw the movie Caddyshack, Be the Ball, this is being the ball. And I love it because there are two ways which you can go down. They either strap you in or they put water in there and they liken it to being like socks in a washer dryer as you roll down the hill. So I love the Zorb Globe. The people who invented it were also very cheeky in that there was a sort of a very popular indie band called Flaming Lips. Some people might know it here, but maybe not. Maybe the wrong demographic. But they wanted one of these balls. They wanted to have a ball for their concert so they could kind of go in and roll around in it. And the inventors of the ball listened to their music and said, we're not giving you a ball. We don't like your music. So they ended up making their own ball that was not nearly as cool as the Zorb Globe. But
have you ever done it?
No, it's on my bucket list of balls, though. So one day I will travel to New Zealand, maybe when my son is older, and we will, as socks in a dryer or a washer, we'll go down a hill together, maybe. Hopefully. If he's up for it. Anything else?
The origins of the ping pong ball, that's got to be interesting. Did the Chinese come up with it? Thousands of years ago?
No, it's actually one thing you'll see if you take some time at the book is that surprisingly the Victorians were obsessed with balls. I mean that in a sports sense, though, because they were pretty prude people generally. But they came up with so many of the different balls that we know of today, whether it was the rugby ball or croquet. Ping pong was one of them. It actually started with rich people in their parlor looking for a way to have fun. And what they would do is they would take champagne corks, cut them off, and knock champagne corks over books with other books. And that's how it started. The one ball that, or the one sort of material that really changed balls was celluloid, which was a plastic. And I can mention in a moment about billiards. And basically, the search for a better billiard ball is the reason we have plastics today, full stop. We would not have plastics if it wasn't for billiard balls. But in relation to the ping pong ball, basically, some people found celluloid and they thought this would be a really good material. Now, what had happened was is Mao Zedong became a big fan of the sport. It kind of worked its way through Japan. And he thought it was going to be a great game to weed out people on drugs in China after World War II. There was a huge opium epidemic, and he thought to himself, if someone can follow this little white ball up and down, they can't be on opium. So that's why a lot of people think that's the reason why he brought that sport to the fore. But billiards, a great story is that ivory balls had been very popular, and of course, in order to get ivory, there's the slaughter of so many elephants. And one would hope that for humanitarian reasons, they stopped slaughtering the elephants, but it was actually for economic reasons. They were becoming fewer and fewer. So a very prominent billiard company made a $10,000 reward for someone who could come up with a better type of billiard ball. And this was in 1860. So this is a time where $10,000 was a king's ransom. No one could do it until a guy named John Wesley Hyatt, by mistake in his bathroom, spilled some colloidal acid. I'm not a PhD, but it's in the book, and I have it right in the book, even though I'm not necessarily described it correctly here. Came across celluloid, and he was able to create celluloid balls, which were the forerunner for all plastics. What was funny about them is that they were highly flammable, and one of the test locations was the 1860s, was a Wild West saloon. And the story goes that some people were playing, and someone had a cigar, put it down, it hit one of the balls, the ball exploded, and everyone pulled out their six-shooter. And so that was a very popular early story about billiard balls. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Hope you enjoy the book if you buy it. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.